Senate Finance Committee to order. It's a couple of minutes after 9 a.m. April the 15th. We're in State Capitol Senate Finance Room. Present today, Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have a full contingent of members today. We have two items on the calendar. The first item being Senate Bill 126, Correctional Facilities Placement, and the second item is House Bill 184, ADA Finance Workforce Housing Development. HB 126, Correctional Facilities Placement. This is the first hearing on this piece of legislation. I invite Senator Yunt and his staff, Ryan McGee, to the table to introduce Senate Bill 126 to the committee and tell us what you're planning to do to us today.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity. I apologize. My chief of staff cannot be with us. He is working on another piece of legislation we have in House Education this morning, so he will not be with us today. Senate Bill, let's see here. Senate Bill 126. So simply put, this is an opportunity to take a look at a minor restructuring of Department of Corrections and possibly relocating some of our inmates to an out-of-state facility where we could save a lot of money. The way that I originally wrote the legislation as it stands before you today, it would be only for individuals with 7 years to life left to serve. At the time, I believe there was 792 inmates that fell inside of those group. And of the 792, 778 were in for violent crimes. The last part of the legislation would direct any money saved from this effort to be help fund public education K through 12 in Alaska. So that's where it stands right now.
Do members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions of Senator Yount at this time? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, thanks for bringing an idea forward on this difficult issue. Corrections costs have been a real troubling one for all of us. Can you help with the vision you have here? Is this everybody with 7 years or more to serve, or some folks with 7 years or more to serve?
At the time, this would be everyone. The 792 inmates at the time was, through the chair, I apologize, Senator Yunt to Senator Keel. At the time, it was all with 7 years remaining or longer. Yes, sir.
Senator Keel.
So does the bill envision that they're outside till they are done with their sentence, or does the bill envision that they're only outside until they have less than 7 years remaining? When do you envision bringing them back?
Senator Keel.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, with no more than 2 years remaining. So they need to come back before there's 2 years or less remaining. Another thing that we've got in the legislation, which I think is very critical, is that there would be no commingling of our inmates with inmates from other states, right? The last thing we want to do is send our Alaskan inmates down, put them into a facility or a wing of a facility with folks from other states where they could possibly start to learn about other things they didn't know, right? I think it would be important to keep our Alaskan inmates together and then bring them home when they have 2 years remaining so that we can start getting them into the workforce again and training and so on and so forth. So.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that because that's just what we did in the past. We imported gangs to Alaska that we didn't have here before.
Yeah.
Our past experience with private prisons is more severe crime in Alaska, more severe drug problems in Alaska, and we paid to import that. So the other question then is doesn't the Department of Corrections have this authority already? What legally changes if the bill passes?
Senator Yacht.
Through the chairman to Senator Keel. Yes, they do have that authority. They have the ability to do that. Why they're choosing not to is a better question for them, or possibly the third floor. But nothing like the influence of the legislature to possibly help make some changes.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just briefly give a breakdown of, you said like 778 of these violent crimes. Well, what kind of violent crimes are we looking at?
Through the chairman to Senator Cronk, Senator Yount for the record. You know, this changes by the day, right? Even the number 792 is probably not the same today. Hopefully it's less, could be more. If you look at the top five crimes, crimes against children and against women were many of the leading ones. And so I don't want to go into too much detail today, but it takes some very bad behavior to get that much time. So it's mainly crimes against children.
Senator Cronk.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some general comments. You know, a few years back, decade plus, we built Goose Creek Prison to bring our prisoners home with the intent there is to, like I mentioned earlier, that some of the issues that they learned in prison brought back to the state wasn't beneficial, and then also to have the prisoners closer to their families. So we went from roughly 20, as I recall, 20 million cost a year to 70, and picked up 300 employees, as I recall, a substantial financial increase to the state. But since then, if we look at the Department of Corrections, it's continually to accelerate in growth at an alarming rate. And we've had here the discussion of difficulty with personnel and vacancies and overtime. And I think that was part of the reason that prompted this discussion here today is the cost of that department. Now, I understand that the interest in trying to fund our schools also, but they're two kind of separate issues. And a little concerned about, you know, that direction in here, because the savings should fall back to the general fund, which frankly needs a higher allocation to education, and we've been working very hard on that this year. But when we look at putting some of these long-term inmates out of state, that will give us the opportunity for prison reduction in space. Maybe we can close one and shrink another one and get some of our costs under control. And I don't want to sound cold-hearted or cold-blooded about all this, but quite frankly, in my opinion, I have no real issue with sending them out of state as long as we can protect our prisoners from bad habits learned, which was mentioned by Senator Keel. And I recognize that they're away from their family, and it's a hardship, and their families might go with them. But I think, Mr. Chairman, we have come a time in our budget on cost controls. We need to have a serious discussion on this issue and encourage control of that department. It's alarming, the growth in the corrections department the last 10 or so years.
I would concur. It's more than the cost of the corrections budget. It's the high escalation of costs that is happening in the correctional industry to the state of Alaska. I've had some meetings with the commissioner and some staff regarding this topic. We may be coming up with something along the lines. I know in the past I've asked for a study to be done why the Alaska Native population, being 20% of the population of the state, is 40% of the inmate population. That study is available now, but there's that increased population. and that report is available for people to read and to digest. But somewhere along the lines, we have to come to grips with that cost. And I would echo Senator Stedman's comments that that we're appreciative of Senator Yount bringing this issue forefront to the Finance Committee, because it is of great concern, and it should be not only to this committee but to the administration and to the general public as well. So hopefully we will come up with seeking some recommendations going forward in the state to address this concern. I'll go to public testimony. We have two individuals today that want to testify on this legislation. In Anchorage, we have Michael Garvey. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Public hearing is open.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Garvey, and I am policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. We acknowledge that Senate Bill 126, as written, does not mandate the transfer of any incarcerated Alaskans to prisons outside. But we oppose the idea of sending Alaska prisoners out of state again, because it jeopardizes their constitutional rights, presents public safety risks, and raises concerns about implementation and costs related to transportation. Alaska's constitution guarantees prisoners the rights to rehabilitation, to due process, to counsel, and to adequate medical care. But sending prisoners thousands of miles away from Alaska's courts, their lawyers, and state oversight would make it immensely challenging to ensure these rights are fulfilled. It would also further separate Alaskans from their families and communities, severing essential ties that are critical for furthering rehabilitation and reducing recidivism. As noted earlier, the last time the state sent prisoners outside, Alaskans were forced to join or form gangs to protect themselves from harm. And when these prisoners returned to Alaska, gang culture came back with them. While SB 126 requires Alaska prisoners to be held separately from others, we're skeptical that total separation would be feasible and could lead to Alaskans being housed in substandard settings. The vast majority of incarcerated Alaskans will leave prison. Sending them out of state again will not set them up well to return to their communities, and it's likely to cost more in the long run than anything Alaska might save up front. If the state wants to reduce costs associated with incarceration, it should increase use of parole, probation, and other ways to hold people in custody outside of institutional settings, and it should reduce the number of severely disabled and older prisoners whose medical care is complex and expensive. Alaska should also ensure better access to rehabilitative programming in-state so that incarcerated people have a better shot at successfully returning to their communities. We would be happy to discuss any of the ideas with the committee further, and we appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns today.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Garvey. We will go to Anchorage and hear from Chet Atkins. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Chet Atkins. I live in Anchorage. I was incarcerated from April of 1987 until March of 2015. I was in the first group of prisoners sent to Arizona in January of 2015, and I returned in May. I was sent there in 1995, and I was returned in 2013. When I left Alaska, there was fights but no real violence, there were no gangs in the system. We got to Arizona. We were housed with federal prisoners. We were housed with Oregon, New Mexico, American Virgin Islands, the Washington, D.C., prisoners, and from all these people, we learned how to be prisoners. We learned how to live by the convict code. We were taught that when we got to the Red Rock Correctional Center, we're housed with the California contract, and there is when the real teaching got started, because we were housed with MS-13, and we were housed with 1488. That's where a lot of the gang issues that you have here came from. One of the biggest problems, the biggest variable cost for corrections is staff pay. So to save money, private corrections doesn't pay their staff much. When we got to Arizona, they're making $9, $10 an hour. And we were in Colorado from 2010 to 2013, they're making around $12 an hour. That made them very easy to corrupt. Drugs and everything you wanted were rampant everywhere. So if you're talking about 10 people back out, you're about to throw gas on the fire instead of, you might be saving money in the short term, but you're going to cause yourself a whole lot more problems in the long term. I'm an Alaska native, and I watched, Native out of state disproportion. We're talking about, Natives being 40% of the inmate population. Well, they were 60 to 70% of the people that came out of state because mostly they didn't fight. So, that's another thing to consider. If you want to start saving money, start dealing with the problem, The problem is, people are experiencing trauma and they haven't been given the means to deal with that. In my opinion, in my experience, if you send people out of state, all you're doing is creating a much bigger problem for yourself down the line. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. We'll go to Adam Barger. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Members of the Senate Finance Committee, thank you for your time this morning. My name is Adam Barger, and I currently reside in Arizona, but am also a formerly incarcerated individual in the Alaska Department of Corrections from 1994 to 2019. And I'm calling to respectfully oppose Senate Bill 126. Since my release from incarceration, I've earned both my bachelor's and master's degrees in criminal justice, and am currently finishing my master's degree in forensic psychology. While incarcerated in Alaska, I spent almost 25 years, 24 years, 10 months, and 14 days to be exact. In that time, I spent almost 16 years of my sentence in private prisons. I spent from 1997 to 2009 in Arizona facilities run by Corrections Corporation of America, who's now rebranded CoreCivic due to the sheer number of lawsuits that CCA had against them. And I also spent almost 4 years in Colorado in a facility that was owned initially by Cornell Corrections, but was subsequently purchased by Geo Group. In short, I've spent a lengthy period of time at every private prison that Alaska prisoners have been housed in, and I speak with confidence when I say that allowing the Commissioner of Corrections the latitude to form a contract with private prison companies ad hoc is a horrible idea. When this bill moved through the Senate State Affairs Committee on February 10th, I provided testimony at length, so I will not burden you with the same testimony, but rather will highlight the points of that testimony. Prior to out-of-state placement, our prison system was not organized and had no gangs to speak of. When we returned from out-of-state placement after 18 years, we were more violent, had gang affiliations, drug addictions, behavioral problems, and were more resistant to authority than those who had not been sent out-of-state. The housing segregation, food, programming, and medical care in out-of-state facilities are inferior to the qualities of those services in Alaska. A major cost in the Alaska Department of Corrections budget is the medical cost for an aging prison population, a cost that will not be reduced by transferring prisoners out of state. And the cross-pollination between out-of-state contracts is a real concern that is not addressed by the legislation as written. Sending Alaska prisoners out of state has an impact on Alaska families, the prisoners themselves, and eventually the community. Sending prisoners out of state thousands of miles away from their family removes rehabilitative aspects of family visitation, which the Alaska Appellate Court found significant in Brandon versus State 938 P2D 1029, a case that was decided in 1997. Separating families in such a way further strains the family bond already stressed by incarceration. The impact on the prisoner population has been previously observed when the first mass shipment occurred in 1995. Until that point, the Alaska prison population had not been segregated by race or ethnicity, and there were no political structure to the population. However, once in a private prison, the Alaska prisoners began organizing themselves, often in response to influence or pressure from other contracts that were housed with us. The gangs we have in the Alaska prison system right now are a direct result from the cross-pollination with other contracts and adopting some of their characteristics. The impact on the Alaska communities will be delayed but inevitable. When DOC Alaska and prisoners out of state, we were gone for almost 20 years. When we came back, we heard about the out-of-state prisoners and how much more difficult we were to manage than those who had not been sent out of state. We were more violent, had gang affiliations, drug addictions, behavioral problems, and we were more resistant than we had ever been. But then we were released back into the community. For some, like myself, we left prison behind us. For many, though, they were apt to get out and return to incarceration, often in conjunction with the new charge. They went back to their communities and created more victims because the behavioral issues they had developed out of state had not been addressed or resolved prior to release. Should this committee need proof of this, merely request a report from the Department of Corrections containing the percentage of prisoner population that was housed out of state and then returned to incarceration after release. I would venture a guess that that percentage is higher than the standard state of recidivism. The two biggest line items in DOC's budget are payroll plus benefits and medical care costs, most of which is spent on an aging prison population, a cost that cannot be deferred by an out-of-state contract. A separate check will be cut for that, which means at current cost, there will be approximately $109 million that will not go back into the Alaska's economy. That money will leave state and will furnish another state's economy. The biggest line item is personnel costs, which includes salary, COLA, and benefits. It appears as though the benefits package for corrections is roughly 60% of their salary. If the legislator addresses these costs, the overall budget will come down. If the legislature feels that the out-of-state transfer of prisoners should be an option, I would like to offer some input. What I propose is that the law be structured in such a way that Alaska DOC uses it as a last resort rather than a first option, and the legislature has direct influence over the outcome. With this structure in place, the citizens of Alaska, through the legislature, will have final decision if they want their fellow citizens sent far from home. If the legislature decides that they do not want the transfer, it will require DOC to find alternative measures to relieve the overcrowding and explore other options such as increasing parole releases, including standard, medical, and geriatric release, electronic monitoring, and CRC placement. The goal of such a structure is to provide Alaska Department of Corrections the proper motivation to find reasonable, sustainable solutions to their overcrowding problems without relying on out-of-state placement as a ready and available solution. Out-of-state placement does not fix the problem. It exacerbates the symptoms of an agency that has failed to properly manage the prison population and curb recidivism. For example, if the statute authorizing the out-of-state transfer of offenders were to require that for a request for a proposal to be published for procurement, the following must occur. The Commissioner of Corrections must request authorization from the legislature to seek an RFP for out-of-state transfer. Before the legislature approves that request, it must go to both chambers for consideration, during which time the request must be published in print, radio, and television media with adequate time for Alaska citizens to contact their legislator and express their approval or disapproval of the request so that the legislature can make an informed decision about whether it is good for Alaska to approve an RFP. The issue must go to the floor of both chambers for a vote, with a majority vote in both chambers required before authorization is given. If the legislature decides to give authorization for an RFP, place a sunset on any contract for out-of-state placement at 5 years from the commencement of the contract, with no renewal period for 24 months. If the legislature decides to deny authorization, Alaska DOC may not submit another request until the following legislative session. Within the five-year time frame, Alaska DOC is required to develop and implement a plan to reduce overcrowding in state prisons and report to the legislature every 6 months on their progress in the implementation. At the end of the five-year contract, the Alaska prisoners are returned to the state, and Alaska DOC is required to provide housing for all returning offenders and may not have a population of more than 100% capacity at any correctional facility or pretrial facility. If at the end of the 24-month cool-down period, Alaska DOC has not resolved the overcrowding issue, they may seek approval for another five-year contract using the same process described above. So long as prisoners are housed out of state, any overtime opportunities that arise must be offered to the eligible employees with the lowest hourly wage first, and then proceed according in ascending order according to hourly wage. Should the legislature decide that they do not want to take up the mantle for authorizing Alaska Department of Corrections to publish a request for proposal, I would recommend that the sunset date provision listed in listed above be implemented so that Alaska DOC has structure to work within and out-of-state placement does not become a semi-permanent resolution like it did the last time.
Thank you
for your time, and I stand available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barger. Senator Keel, fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Senate Bill 126 has one fiscal note from the Department of Corrections Institution Director's Office. It is a zero fiscal note.
Thank you. The public hearing process is closed. Senator. Senator Stedman, brief eddies. The meeting back to order. I might have acted too hastily. Was there anybody in the audience that would like to testify at this time? No one in the audience that wants to testify, so the public hearing is closed. Senator Yant, do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside? Oh, Senator Merrick, sorry I didn't recognize you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Yunt, can you give us the cost of a day out-of-state versus in-state prison?
Mr. Yunt, Senator Yunt?
Yes, Senator Yunt, through the chair to Senator Merrick. Right now, to house an in-state inmate, it's a little over $200 a day. I want to say somewhere between $200 and $220. We need to look at the new numbers. So the numbers I had from last year were about $203, but I think those have increased. Out of state, you're anywhere from a third to a quarter of that.
Okay, so. Super. And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Merrick.
There were two amend recommendations out of Senate State Affairs. Do you know what amendments that those two legislators were hoping to see?
Through the chair to Senator Merrick, no, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
We could see if we can contact those and get their recommendations to the committee. Further questions by Senate Finance members? Seeing none, closing comments, Senator Young.
Yes, sir. In regard to some of the comments, I those are heartfelt comments and concerns, and I share the same ones. And so that's why in Section 1 it clearly states that we would not – I don't think any RFP should be allowed to go forward with it. If it includes cross-pollination, I think we would have to keep our inmates separated. And it should be a last resort thing. Right? This is not – I tell you, we've had multiple committee hearings on this bill now, multiple conversations. There's nothing enjoyable about this for me. I don't enjoy this. This is just where we are, and this is the reality of which our budget exists, and it's an option. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Yant. We will set this bill aside. For further consideration, that brings us to the second item on today's agenda, which is HB 184, ADA, Finance Workforce Housing Development. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Senator Story to the table to introduce the bill to the committee. See, she's not here. We have her staff, Sherry Bowman. Please identify yourself. Proceed with your introduction.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hoffman. For the record, I'm Sherry Bowman. I'm staff to Representative Andy Story, representing House District 3. And I appreciate you hearing House Bill 184 today. This bill puts into statute that the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, also known as ADA, can finance workforce housing development projects of 5 dwelling units or more. It is hard to find a community in Alaska today that is not negatively impacted by our housing shortage, which is at crisis levels. The shortage is very discouraging to Alaskans and businesses and other service industries, and it is a persistent barrier to our state's economic growth. At our Regional Southeast Conference this fall, a top priority was supporting the development of housing. And this holds true for many communities throughout our state. This housing shortage is contributing to our ongoing population loss, with high rates of out-migration of our working-age population. Potential new residents to our state turn down employment when they can't find housing, contributing to our low immigration and workforce shortage. At Juneau's local hospital in the last few months, they lost at least 12 potential new employees who rescinded their agreement to come to Juneau when they could not find housing. Many other employees across the state have cited similar issues. Construction has not kept up with housing demand, especially for multi-dwelling units that serve working individuals, families, and industry needs. The higher costs of construction, often more than double those in the lower 48, discourage developers from building. Housing developments that are being built continue to focus on single-family or higher-priced condo units rather than higher-density developments that could achieve some affordability through scale. Standalone work housing developments of 5 dwelling units or more for Alaskan businesses and service agencies are desperately needed. Many workforce housing projects do not pencil out unless there are additional financing tools, such as those that ADA can offer. This bill helps. The bill expands ADA's purpose in statute to include providing financing for the construction of new workforce housing facilities containing 5 or more dwelling units. ADA's various means of financing and means of facilitating financing can help developers afford to do housing construction projects. ADA's loan participation program, where ADA provides longer-term financing for projects such as workforce housing that cannot secure financing through the banks, can help reduce project risk for developers and make workforce housing projects more likely to be built. Their private activity bonds are tax exempt and a resource for businesses. There have been discussions on whether ADA can do commercial housing, and this clarifies it can. This is companion legislation to this body's District J member. It is also important to note that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, AHFC, does not provide construction lending. This bill does not force ADA to do any project. Rather, ADA will still be assessing each housing project on its merit for investment. This bill represents a positive step that the legislature can take to do something about housing opportunities. It incentivizes the construction of multi-dwelling housing units through expanding ADA's purpose in statute. I believe that many Alaskans strongly support ADA funds being used to help increase the supply of affordable housing in Alaska. More multi-dwelling housing units will help reverse net migration losses. This is essential for a strong Alaskan economy, and with resource development projects increasing, we need more housing more than ever. Thank you again, co-chairs and committee members, for hearing this bill. Today, we do have Juneau Economic Development Council's Executive Director, Brian Holst, and private building contractors, Victor Benazic and Sean Debenham, here and online to provide invited testimony in support of this bill. Also online, I have ADA Deputy Director Brandon Brushinski and Special Counsel Mark Davis, as well as Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Governmental Relations and Public Affairs Director Stacy Barnes, available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bowman. Do members of the Senate Finance Committee have questions for the sponsor of the bill, Senator Kronk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, doesn't AHFC do this? Don't they have the ability to do multi?
Ms. Bowman.
Through the chair, again, Sherry Bowman, staff to Representative Story. Senator Kronk, I believe Stacey Barnes is available online, and she can answer that question for you.
Further questions? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think when we have that discussion, it would be nice to see the terms that generally a commercial bank offer versus Alaska Housing versus ADA, and what the differences are on those. Because my understanding with ADA, they can do workforce housing. I know we've talked to them about workforce housing in the shipyard in Ketchikan that they own, and this is a little different twist. But and then as another question, is there, when you have 5 units, is there a restriction that ADA can't do something, you know, like multiple fourplexes, or it has to be five units, or can, I think so we just need a little help with some of that.
With clarification, again, through the chair, Sherry Bowman, staff representative story. Senator Steadman, you just want some clarification on whether Ada can do my understanding is that the definition of workforce housing, according to Ada, is that it is five dwelling units or more. But I can allow Deputy Director Brandon Breschinski, who is online, to answer that question for you.
She can answer it when she testifies. Further questions, Senator Steadman?
No.
Further questions from the Finance Committee members? If not, we will go to invited testimony. The first individual that we have signed up for invited testimony is Brian Holtz, the Executive Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council, in person today. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your invited testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Olson, and Steadman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 184. And for the record, my name is Brian Holst. I'm the director of the Juneau Economic Development Council. Alaska has 13 consecutive years of net out-migration and has lost approximately 35,000 working-age residents since 2013. At our recent 2026 Innovation Summit, we looked at Alaska migration and saw that we tend to gain people in their 20s, but we lose them in their 30s when adults are forming families, buying homes, and deciding where to put down roots. These adults in their family formation years often leave Alaska because their expectations of school quality, housing, and other amenities in their communities are not being met. At the same time, Alaska's non-resident workforce is at the highest levels we've seen since the early 90s, with about 23% of our jobs filled by people who do not live here year-round. This tells us that jobs exist, but many workers do not see Alaska as a viable place to make it their home, in part because they cannot reliably secure housing that fits their needs and budgets. Juneau's housing data illustrate this challenge faced by many communities in Alaska. Our rental vacancy rate was close to 4% in 2025 and has been below 5% in 10 of the last 11 years, compared with a healthy range closer to 7%. Medium apartment rent rate rose again last year by 4% higher than inflation. New home construction has been running at just over 100 units per year in our community since 2020, following the lowest decade of new home building in Juneau since the 1950s. Put together, data show a market where rents are rising, vacancies are too low, construction is too slow, home prices rise faster than inflation, and some of our available housing stock is being pulled towards short-term rentals and out of year-round residency. These housing pressures are emerging as Juneau and Southeast Alaska have real opportunities to grow income and jobs. We expect expansion of the U.S. Coast Guard and ongoing investment in tourism and potential mining projects, all of which require a stable local workforce and adequate housing. In 2027, we expect to initiate $1 billion in new construction activity in Juneau. Without more workforce housing units, we will struggle to fill those positions with Alaskan residents and rely even more on non-resident workers who spend less of their time and income in our communities. HB 184 is a practical tool to connect our statewide development finance authority to our state's housing challenges. The bill amends Ada's purpose and power statutes to explicitly include providing various means of financing and means of facilitating the financing of construction of new workforce housing facilities containing five or more dwelling units. It also adds workforce housing to the list of Ada projects, which makes these developments fully eligible for Ada's existing project finance tools. That matters because ADA already operates loan participation programs with banks and can offer long amortization periods, which can improve the viability and bankability of a project. HB 184 does not require ADA to fund any specific project. The authority will still apply its own underwriting and evaluate risk and economic benefit. It does not displace AHFC, which focuses on 1-4 unit housing and lending and broader housing programs, but fills a gap for 5-plus unit workforce projects that need flexible long-term financing. By putting workforce housing clearly into ADA's mission, the bill removes ambiguity that may have discouraged potential projects and signals that housing for workers is recognized as critical economic infrastructure. HB 184 asks ADA to do in housing what it already does for energy, ports, and industrial projects, namely to fill capital gaps, de-risk good projects, and bring private lenders to the table. HB 184 can also be a helpful step towards slowing out migration, reducing reliance on non-resident labor, and making it realistic for working Alaskans to stay and raise families where the jobs are right here in Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Brian. We invite Victor Banzik to the table, owner of VRB Construction LLC. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
Good morning. My name is Victor Banizak, and I appreciate the chair and the rest of the council for allowing me to speak here today. I have a very brief testimony in support of HB 184. I figured I would just speak, and then if you have questions from a builder perspective, I'm happy to answer those. My name is Victor Banizak. I was born and raised in Southeast Alaska. I've been a builder here in Juneau for nearly 25 years. I currently serve on Alaska State Home Building Association as a board member, and I was its president in 2020. I also serve as the current president of the Southeast Alaska Building Industry Association. I've also been asked to sit on the AHFC code council committee right now for the last. We just created it this year, and we're in our second year. I'm basically here to share with what we as builders are facing on the ground when we're trying to deliver housing. The biggest hurdle right now is cost. The cost to build housing has skyrocketed. Materials are expensive. Labor costs are high. And in places like Juneau, land is extremely limited. On top of that, code requirements continue to tighten, especially for multifamily construction. The cost to build new can be as much as 40% higher than its equivalent on the existing market. Because of this, many projects that would create much-needed housing simply can't get off the ground. This directly impacts local businesses, as you've heard this morning. Each, even well-established companies, are struggling to stay open, not because there aren't the jobs, but because there's no places for the workers to live. Even when wages are strong, the cost and availability of housing just doesn't pencil out. From a builder's perspective, this issue often comes down to financing. Even if a project makes sense, on paper, traditional lenders aren't always able to carry them, especially in smaller or constrained markets. And no one trying to make a living can build at a loss. If our resources and crews are tied up delivering housing that doesn't financially work, then the housing just simply won't happen. That's where the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority can play a critical role. I think of it as gap insurance on a vehicle. Traditional financing may not cover the whole cost needed to move a project forward in today's environment, and ADA wouldn't replace banks. It would just partner with them, possibly helping fill that gap so viable projects can move ahead. I would encourage the committee to consider tools such as targeted grants, extended financing, interest rate support, tax abatement or deferral, or other mechanisms that can help projects make them feasible. These tools allow builders to recover costs and deliver housing while supporting their crews and businesses. At the end of the day, if we want a workforce in Alaska, we need places for people to live, and we need the tools to build them. I believe HB 184 helps provide that tool, and I appreciate the work that this committee is doing to support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Banizak. The last individual we have for invited testimony is online from Sean Debenham, president of Debenham LLC. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to testify. This is Sean Debenham with Debenham LLC here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm calling in support of House Bill 184. I'm a local developer here in Anchorage. I specialize in workforce housing and apartment building here in Anchorage. We're actually doing a development this summer of 58 townhomes. And this particular bill would be a great addition to the tool box for me as I move forward with development. Construction financing in particular is hard to get. Usually once the project is up and going and stabilized, we can find financing, but construction financing in particular is hard to come by. And we don't have a lot of financiers for that. With that, I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have, but I fully support House Bill 184.
Thank you for that invited testimony. We do have three individuals that are available for questions by the Finance Committee, for the Finance Committee, before we go to public testimony. I will inform the committee that we do have individuals from ADA, the Deputy Director, Brandon, I can't pronounce his last name.
Brzezinski,
and Mark Davis from ADA, as well as Stacy Barnes from AHFC. They are all online for questions from the Finance Committee. But with that, if there are no specific questions, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'd like to hear from ADA. It seems how this affects them. I know they've been looking at trying to help with housing around Alaska, and it'd just be nice to get their input.
Yes, it's Brzezinski. Mr. Brzezinski or Mr. Davis, do you have some assistance for Senator Stedman?
For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director for ADA. Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, I would say that ADA is neutral on this legislation. We believe that we have statutory authority to finance a multi-unit, a commercial operation. For housing, we would not do single family homes. That's not our business. And then there's a question regarding why 5 units, and I would defer that to Mr. Davis to address.
Senator Stedman. Mr. Davis. Why do we need 5 units?
For the record, my name is Mark Davis. I'm counsel to ADA. The question is regarding 5 units or more. That's typical of state statutes on workforce development because fourplexes, threeplexes, and duplexes are usually or often owner-occupied, and the intent of workforce development housing is not to have owner-occupied units.
Why can't you just state that any workforce development units would not be available for owner occupancy, thereby allowing for 3 and 4-plex units?
Senator, that could be another way to phrase it. We're just looking at the way the bill got done, and there was always in this bill a number set forth, and so that was the way it was drafted. However, what you're saying could be a potential way to draft the bill. Again, though, I think it's appropriate that workforce housing be aimed at providing the accommodations for the workers of a particular business and not for the owner.
Because for financing, it would be much easier for individuals out there to finance a 3 or 4-plex unit, and they may not have the necessary financing or the land available for a 5-plex unit. That would seem to be a better solution. Senator Stedman, additional comments?
Fine.
That's fine. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I have some questions. I don't know if they can be answered today, but the testimony we just heard today is that the constraints, combination of cost of land, cost of materials, cost of labor, and so just the economic equation, I'm wondering if we put more money into that, if that adds monetary policy-driven inflation on top of that. So I'm just, what I'm pondering is this will actually result in affordable housing that could be afforded by the, you know, the target market for this. So that's a basic economic thing I'm pondering. The other piece of it is just organizationally, I'm not clear on how the entities AHFC and ADA, are we creating duplication or overlap in purpose? And if we do something, are we going in the right direction with this proposal? So those are the two areas, the big picture areas I'm pondering right now.
Do either anyone from ADA or AHFC want to comment upon Senator Kaufman's comments?
Mr. Chairman, this is Brandon Brzezinski, again, for the record, Deputy Director, ADA. Regarding the economic impacts to inflation, ADA has not done an analysis on that, but I understand the position that you're coming from. And then in regards to the duplicative purpose of ADA versus AHFC, that's intuitive to me, given, AHFC has housing in their name. But I would defer to them to speak to, on behalf of AHFC. But as of right now, ADA could finance a multi-unit apartment complex or infrastructure necessary to support, like, utilities, things like that, for multi-unit housing projects. We currently don't have any applications before us for this, but we have been engaged with local communities, local officials, with the administration. I know the governor has an idea, has a plan for housing, working closely with AHFC on that. So there are things being done to try to address this area that involve both ADA and AHFC, but there's been no specific plan identified yet and no applications, like I said, for the authority.
Thank you. Does Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, when we look at least in my region of the state, the risk areas of the housing, a significant portion of that is in the land development, the cost and the land, the subdivision, the water, sewer, all your utilities, and then the added burdens sometimes the communities want to put on top. That creates a difficult hurdle to get a subdivision off the ground. So does this financing mechanism, that would include the real property also?
Is there individual ADA or HFC or director?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, through the chair, Brandon Brzezinski, the director. In theory, we could include the cost of the land. Currently, ADA has the ability to finance real property, to purchase, acquire real property, all of the above. So, in theory, it could be rolled in as part of the total package for the development. I refer to the work that AHFC has been doing, too, with the governor. I know the governor has a plan that would address this land issue as well and try to make it more affordable or at least economic to develop multi-unit housing.
Okay, Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kroc.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, what I'm trying to understand here is you really don't need this legislation. You could already do this through ADA. Yes or no?
Through the chair, Senator Crum, yes.
If you say yes, why? Yeah. What are the advantages of this bill, in your view?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I would say that clarity in statute is a good thing at times. But otherwise, ADA has the broad statutory authorities to finance what I believe this bill is trying to accomplish.
further questions of the individuals available for answering them? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brzezinski, so clarity and perhaps a statement of the legislature's interest as we work with the governor on the funding package he put together for some new subdivisions and the like, I think worthwhile to look at taking both approaches, because I like the governor's proposal too. If this bill were to pass, would ADA regard this as authority to or a nudge in the direction of undertaking multifamily projects itself or using the loan participation program, direct finance, builder to directly from ADA? What would be the structure if most likely to be used if this bill was passed?
Thank you, Senator Keel. Is anyone specific you're directing?
Mr. Brzezinski, if I may.
Mr. Brzezinski.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Brzezinski, Deputy Director. Through the Chair, Senator Keel, I would take an all-of-the-above approach. We could find, except for, I do not believe ADA would be owning a multi-unit operation. We would stick to financing that type of a development, and whether that's through ADA's direct program or through the loan participation program, which that would involve another bank bringing a loan to ADA, where we would then participate in that financing. Currently, the loan participation program does not provide construction financing. It provides permanent financing, so post-construction. That is a regulation, and that is something we're looking at too, regarding if there is a way to provide construction financing through the LPP program or a blend of sorts with our direct program in the LPP program. But again, there's nothing in statute per se that would prohibit us from doing that. It's the regulations, and admittedly they're a little outdated, and they contemplate when ADA used to fund loan participations via bonds, which we currently don't. We have not issued bonds to provide the funding for loan participation. So the permanent financing restriction would have been a covenant had we have issued bonds to fund the LPP. That's in regs, like I said. They're looking at that to broaden the program potentially into construction, but nothing is certain right now. There's a lot of moving parts. We've had conversations with some of the banks as well, because we wouldn't want to do something that was going to get, you know, other sectors set. But those conversations are underway.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't imagine anybody will have it at the tip of their fingers, but I'd be interested in maybe some illustration of what ADA's loan participation could do in terms of helping the total funding package of a multifamily development. You'd have to come up with a hypothetical. They're all different, but I'd be interested. We've heard from folks in the building community and the economic development community that getting into this loan participation or ADA financing mechanism could help them with the difficult job of developing housing, and I'd be interested in maybe just a hypothetical or two about what that looks like to a pro forma.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Keel. Currently, like I referred to earlier, the loan participation program is for like post-construction for permanent financing, but what that looks like today would be that a bank would, there would be a commercial loan through a bank, and the bank would bring that loan to ADA for participating in our loan participation program, where statutorily we are allowed to take up to 90%, up to $25 million without requiring legislative approval. We take out the loan from the bank, so ADA becomes a lender, and our rate that we use is typically lower than what the commercial rate is. So it helps, you know, the blended rate helps with the economics of the financing for that particular project or business, what have you. But it's post-construction, and what we hear from builders and what you've heard even today is that some of the hurdles, some of the, like, the upfront cost, the construction cost, the pre, you know, revenue, you know, once the apartment or multi-unit operation is up and running, that is the hurdle to the financing. But I would defer to the builders, the developers, to provide further insights on that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Further questions? Seeing none, we will open the public hearing and go to Anchorage and hear from Maggie McKay. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Maggie McKay, and I am speaking as a member of the Long Range Planning Committee at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Anchorage. I'm calling in support of House Bill 184. Our church is actively working on a housing project, and this effort really comes from a commitment to serving our community. One of the biggest challenges we've run into is putting together a capital stack that actually works. Even when there is strong community support, it's incredibly difficult to line up the right mix of funding to move a project forward. There are a lot of barriers to getting workforce housing built, and projects can stall out even when there's real momentum behind them. At the same time, we're seeing how the lack of workforce housing affects people directly, whether that's families trying to stay in the community or workers who want to be here but can't find a place to live. Housing is foundational to strong, stable communities. Anything that helps bring another financing partner to the table and makes workforce housing projects more feasible is incredibly valuable from our perspective. This is exactly the kind of support that helps turn a shared community goal into something that actually gets built. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Senator Keel, review of the fiscal note.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 184 has one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. They give the bill a zero fiscal note.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Before we set this bill aside, does the prime sponsor staff, Ms. Bauman, have any closing comments?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hoffman and committee members. I just want to stress that this bill is meant to incentivize the construction of workforce housing development projects and to, right now we just need all hands on deck, basically. And so, we just would really like to put this in statute just so that we can, get this up and running. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bauman. We will set this bill aside. That concludes this morning's agenda. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We have the closeout, subcommittee closeout for the University of Alaska, chaired by Senator Keel. It's a committee of the whole. And the second item is hearing invited testimony on HB 78. With that, anything else to come before the committee? We stand adjourned.